Good morning. We're ready for argument in the case of Land Title Insurance Corporation versus Ameriquest Mortgage Company. And the petitioner may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Larry Hamill, appearing on behalf of Land Title Insurance Corporation and Title Acquisitions, Inc. Three issues are pending before the court on this appeal, as governed by the order granting certiorari. I'll address each of those in the order that they are listed in that order granting certiorari. First issue is whether the Court of Appeals application of the doctrine of equitable subrogation on the facts of this case abrogates what we have referred to as the foreclosure title statute, and that is CRS 3838501. As the court is aware, the policy, public policy behind the recording statutes in Colorado is to assure reliable title. The title recording statute, which is 3835109, states in essence that an unrecorded document is not binding upon anybody except the parties to that document or persons with actual knowledge. In this case, as the court is aware, the Ameritech deed of trust was not recorded for 4 months after the loan transaction by which Ameritech loaned money to Mr. and Mrs. Battles. In that period of time, Land Title Insurance Company, or Insurance Corporation, excuse me, which is, by the way, an insurance corporation, it is not the Land Title Guarantee, which is a title agency. This is the title insurance company. It had acquired a deed of trust, note in deed of trust, and in that period of time, default occurred on that note in deed of trust, and it's commenced foreclosure. In that period of time, of course, it checked the title. Title did not show any interest of Ameritech, and under the foreclosure statutes, Ameritech was not entitled to notice of the pending foreclosure. Ameritech was on constructive notice once the notice of demand and sale was recorded by Land Title Insurance, so that it could have and should have known about the foreclosure that was proceeding. It apparently did not check title, and it did not confirm that the title, that its title work had been done properly by its agent, Northwest Title. And as a result, it was unaware of the foreclosure that was proceeding. Mr. and Mrs. Battles.
Could I interrupt you by what you mean it didn't confirm that its title work had been done? That is just simply that it hadn't been recorded. That's all you're referring to.
Its instructions to its agent, Northwest Title, was to record the
deed
of trust.
That's the only thing you're referring to in terms of what wasn't done.
It was not done for 4 months.
Okay.
That's correct, Your Honor. From the point of view of recording, there are other things that were not done, but from the point of view of recording its lien interest, it was not done for 4 months.
That's what I wanted. You seemed like you were talking about maybe something broader than that, but really what we're talking about is the failure to record.
That's correct.
Thank you, sir.
That is essentially the linchpin of the issues
sure.
in this case is their failure to record. As a result of their failure to record, they did not get notice until sometime the following year. Battles, of course, who are their lenders, their borrowers, were fully informed of the pending foreclosure. And it is important to remember that all of the procedures that are set forth in the statutes, both judicial and statutory, were followed by Land Title. Assiduously. There's nothing in the record that would indicate that Land Title was withholding information from anyone, although it's accused of being a savvy person trying to take advantage of this process in achieving an unjust enrichment. There's nothing in the record to support that. What the record does support is that Land Title assiduously followed all of the rules and got a clean title. The recording title, or the recording statute, interrelates with what we've referred to as the foreclosure title statute, because if you once file foreclosure and you follow the foreclosure procedures, then it is clear that 3838501 on its face says that upon expiration of the redemption period, title shall mandatory and automatic vest in the holder of certificate of purchase. And that holder of certificate of purchase in this case was Land Title Insurance Corporation, which at that point in time, after that point in time, was wholly unaware of Ameritech's...
But you've argued another consequence of the statutes, and that is that unrecorded liens are extinguished, right?
Yeah, not only does title vest, but the statute goes on, 3838501 goes on to say that all junior liens, and that's junior liens, whether they're equitable or legal, are extinguished. And in First Interstate Bank versus Tank Deck, this court held that not only are they extinguished, it is as if they had never even existed. In other words, it is a complete abrogation of whatever lien rights are junior to those that are foreclosed. And of course, this lien right of Ameritech was junior. It's important to remember that the purpose behind that redemption statute and the automatic vesting of title is to protect people who go through the process of foreclosure. Here, the parties to this lawsuit were Land Title Insurance, Title Acquisitions, Inc., some other persons who had potential lien because of judgments that they had in their possession, and John Doe's 1 through 5. Turns out that the John Doe's 1 through 5 in this case are the Petersons. The Petersons are the persons who ultimately purchased the property from Title Acquisitions after it had received a deed from the public trustee, substantially improved the property, and a number of months later, 7 months later, sold the property to the Petersons. That has been sort of lost in the shuffle in the briefing, that the Petersons' claim was the one that was really at risk here. If the court will recall, there was a stipulation by the parties that Ameriquest would not seek to foreclose their lien, which they think has priority through subrogation or some other legal theory, would not seek to foreclose their lien against the Petersons if there was agreement to simply resolve the matter by allocating the sales proceeds that Land Title or Title Acquisitions had received. But we shouldn't lose sight of that fact, because the thrust of this was to dispossess the Petersons of their title, or at least subject it to the prior lien of $500,000+ that is being claimed by Ameriquest. The whole idea of the extinguishment of junior liens is that those liens are gone. And that persons who have taken through foreclosure and then subsequent to that foreclosure, such as the Petersons and maybe even somebody down further the line, do not have to worry about the kinds of claims that are being asserted in this case. The ruling of the Court of Appeals would permit Ameriquest to defease the title of the Petersons for individual, independent, unrelated, innocent purchasers. That is exactly what the foreclosure title statute is entitled or is enacted for, is to protect that process.
Would you explain that a little bit to me? What if their position was actually just to recoup the amount that they were owed? How is that a dispossession of title?
Well, it's a dispossession of many of the muniments of title, because it puts them subject to a $500,000 deed of trust that they never thought existed. That's the essence of it.
Okay.
This is the Petersons?
The Petersons, Your Honor, yes. Because they are the purchasers ultimately from Title Acquisitions. But whether it's Title Acquisitions or the Peterson is really not relevant or not material in this case, because both parties are protected by the lien foreclosure statute. There is no case that has been cited to this court, and we have found no case, which applies the doctrine of equitable subrogation, or for that matter any other equitable doctrine, to defeat the title of that has been obtained through the complete foreclosure process. In fact, in Mount Carbon versus Lake George, the statement of that court, which was the Court of Appeals, was that after there has been a completion of the foreclosure, the equitable powers of the court are constrained. It may not set aside a completed foreclosure sale absent a finding of fraud, deceit, collusion, or that a party was misled by the public trustee. In other words, there are very few and rare circumstances where a foreclosure sale can be interfered with by the application of equitable principles.
Mr. Hamill, yes. Could you just discuss a little bit about, we already said that equitable subrogation applies to the race notice statute, and why shouldn't that same rationale apply here?
Well, because in this case...
What's different? Not so much in this case, but to the statute itself.
Are you
talking the foreclosure, about? I'm talking about comparing the two statutes, the foreclosure statute versus the race notice statute.
Well, of course, the race notice statute is the underpinning of the foreclosure statute.
That's right.
And in Landre, which this court decided, the court did rule that there was a narrow exception to the
right.
race notice statute in giving certain circumstances being
right.
satisfied.
So if, I guess as a principle, I'm not talking about applied to specifically this case. I understand you have lots of arguments otherwise, but... Why, if we said that it applies in Hicks, why shouldn't it apply here in general?
You recall a comment by the Supreme Court in the ultimate Landry decision, and it said that we are bound by our precedent unless the legislature decided to abrogate that precedent.
Sure.
And in that case, there had been no abrogation of that precedent. Our contention is that the foreclosure title statute specifically abrogates that concept of equitable subrogation in the context of foreclosure, because it says that all liens are cut off, period. They don't ever, they've never even existed. What they want here, what America Quest wants here, is a reinstatement of its lien and then a promotion to priority. That is precluded specifically by the lien, or by the foreclosure title statute. And that's how the two interrelate with respect to the Landry case.
Does foreclosure statute predate or postdate that case?
The foreclosure statute predate or postdate?
Predate or postdate the Hicks versus Landry case?
The foreclosure title statute has been in existence for years, Your Honor. So, yes, it predates the Landry case.
Do you think that we need to modify or overrule that case?
Landry?
Yes.
No, I don't, because I think Landry is good law. It just doesn't apply here. And the reason it doesn't apply here is, A, the foreclosure title statute abrogates that doctrine here. And secondly, in these, on the facts of this case, factor number 5 of the Landry decision is not met. Land title, which assiduously complied with the law and relied upon recording statutes to its detriment, would be harmed. In factor number 5 in the Landry case says that the intervening lien holder, the junior lien holder, is not harmed. Well, here, land title would be specifically harmed because it is not put in a position behind another deed of trust or another lien of some sort, but it loses its title altogether because it has obtained legal title, free and clear of all liens, all subordinate liens. So it's not just a question of one party being put ahead of the other. It's a question, in this case, of land title being dispossessed of its property, of its property title.
Mr. Hamill, you said it doesn't, the foreclosure title statute doesn't apply here, and it's here that I maybe misunderstood. I thought you argued in your briefs that as a matter of law, it doesn't apply. And it shouldn't apply.
The foreclosure title statute doesn't apply?
In this case. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm saying it backwards. That equitable subrogation doesn't apply to as a matter of law. Is that?
It does not apply to the facts of this case.
As opposed to as a matter of law in terms of principle, any case?
No, I think that the decision in Landry is a correct decision. Okay. I think equitable subrogation is a doctrine that's been recognized for years.
I think I understand.
It doesn't apply here.
I understand your position.
As I say, we find no case which applies the doctrine of equitable subrogation or any other kind of equitable relief on the facts in this case. And that's for good reason. The lien, which is trying to be reinstated here, has been extinguished. It never existed as a matter of law under the foreclosure title statute. They have argued in their briefs that somehow or another their lien was not junior, but was senior on the concept of equitable subrogation or an equitable lien. Those doctrines they seem to apply them automatically. In other words, if they come in, they say we are entitled to equitable subrogation, and therefore we were a senior lien and were not discharged by the foreclosure statute. As this court recognized in the Landry case and in other cases, and as the universal rule, automatic application of subrogation, equitable subrogation, simply does not occur. It is very fact specific, and subrogation does not take place until there has been a determination by a court of the appropriate facts. The same would be true of an equitable lien. Therefore, the argument they really had a senior lien rather than a junior lien fails by its own force. Equitable subrogation in this case would be inappropriate because equitable subrogation of the concepts that were set forth in Landry relate to competing interests of persons with an interest in real estate or in property. Here there is a lien, was their lien, whatever their lien may have been, their unrecorded deed of trust, was extinguished. They had no further interest in the property whatsoever. For that matter, neither did land title, because its foreclosure had extinguished its lien rights. The concept of equitable subrogation basically is one of ordering priority of competing liens. There are no liens here to order the priority of. There are no existing liens, period. So for that reason alone, the doctrine of equitable subrogation does not apply here. But as I pointed out, the fifth element, that subrogation would not work any injustice to the rights of a junior lien holder, is not satisfied here. First of all, there is no junior lien holder because Land Title had no junior lien. AmeriQuest had no lien, junior or senior. But certainly, the rights of and interests of Land Title were affected, and were affected negatively by the application of subrogation in this case.
Mr. Hamill, may I ask you one question about your understanding of the doctrine of equitable subrogation at all? Because of your argument seems tied very much to the notion that the junior lien holder's lien was extinguished, and therefore we don't have a question of two lien holders. But do you understand the doctrine of equitable subrogation as being limited to a junior lien holder taking the place of a senior, or simply any person that in equity should, for instance, who has paid off the debt of, or for whatever reason, should be placed in the position of the senior lien holder?
If they're being placed in the position of a lien holder, perhaps. In the Landre case, as the court will recall, equitable subrogation was granted not only to the Landre's lender, but to the Landre's, because they had contributed to the purchase price of the property, which had paid off the old lien. So equitable subrogation is not technically just between lien holders. It is principally between lien holders, but it certainly is between owners of interest in property and lien holders, and it orders their priorities of rights.
And I guess that leads me to the question then, if it's not strictly limited to the relationship between lien holders and one taking the place of another, why is it that the foreclosure statute, more specifically than the recording statute, abrogates the doctrine?
Because whatever right that AmeriQuest had was based upon their lien. If you're talking about what rights they had to step into the shoes of Washington Mutual, the deed of trust that was paid off, I'm perhaps not understanding your question, Justice Coates.
Well, no, I am, but I was going back to Justice Bender's question about distinguishing what we did with regard to the recording statute, the way in which we found that the doctrine of equitable subrogation could exist despite the recording statute. And you seem to be arguing, but the foreclosure statute is a different case because it specifically abrogates the doctrine.
Yes, I think it is very different.
And if the doctrine is not limited to lien holders, how does extinguishing the junior lien, as the foreclosure statute does, how does that abrogate the doctrine of equitable subrogation?
Again, I'm not sure I understand your question, okay. But if the idea is that someone who has no interest in the property could come in and pay off a loan and thereby find himself in a position of equitable subrogation, I don't think that's what equitable subrogation is about at all. But it is that somebody who expects his lien position to be someplace other than he thought it was going to be, or his property interests other than where he thought it was going to be, finds himself behind a secret lien. He then equitably subrogates to the lien that he paid off. Here there was no property interest in AmeriQuest except the interest that it obtained through its deed of trust, unrecorded deed of trust. And it is attempting to dispossess the Petersons, who are innocent parties, who are persons who would be affected by this. They would be, in effect, the junior lien holders, if you wanted to put them in that context, because they are now the property title holders, mm-hmm. Land Title, which was in the position of owning property. They find themselves now in a position where they would be subrogated, or they would be subordinated, rather, to a position of higher priority of some dollar amount. That's the fifth element of the Landre case. The Landre case says that the junior lien holder, or in this case the property owner, would not be negatively affected by its reliance upon the recording process, and in this case the foreclosure process.
And just one last stab at that, and that's sort of where I'm going. Maybe although we're not fully understanding each other, I think you're answering the question, but that I'm concerned about, and that is, it seemed to me you're saying two things. One is this foreclosure statute, that equitable subrogation could never apply to adversely affect the consequence that the foreclosure statute would require, because it's expressly abrogated the doctrine. Subsequently, though, it seems to me what you seem to be saying is, but if you get so far as to be a situation that would be controlled by the foreclosure statute, you'd always have prejudice
and therefore the conditions of equitable subrogation wouldn't be satisfied.
That is certainly correct, the facts of this case, and I think as a general principle, that's correct.
Okay.
That's the difference between the equitable subrogation circumstances in Landry and the equitable circumstances here, because we've got the intervention of the foreclosure title statute, where the court, well, the legislature has specifically said, we are wiping out those liens, and they cannot come back in. They are extinguished. The other aspect of the equitable subrogation argument that we spent some time on the brief in is that even if the five elements of Landry equitable subrogation were met, which they were not here, the negligence of Ameriquest should defeat their claim of any kind of equitable subrogation. They failed to record their deed of trust. They failed to investigate their borrower. They failed to proceed in any kind of way to protect their interest in this property after they became, in fact, aware of the foreclosure that was being proceeded on by land title. The argument that they are not bound by the negligence of Northwest Title simply falls by its own weight. It is true that if a title company does something as in Landry, where they missed a recorded document, that may not be attributable to the person claiming equitable subrogation. That is certainly not the case here. There are a number of instances, which we've all laid out in our briefs, where Ameriquest simply did not do anything to protect its interest, did not investigate, did not follow up, didn't do anything to assure that their recording took place. If there's any fault in this case, it is the fault of Ameriquest and its agents, or the Battles, of course, who are the fraudulent parties in the first place. But certainly between Ameriquest and Land Title, there is no fault by comparison. Land Title did nothing wrong. It proceeded in accordance with the statutes. It got clean title.
Well, does Ameriquest have any action against its agent?
I would think so. It would if it were my client, because I think it's clear that that agent breached its duty. In a number of ways, but most fundamental to this case, it simply sat on a deed of trust for 4 months. No explanation as to why that occurred, but it was fatal to Ameriquest in this case. So yes, I would think they would have a cause of action. In that case, equity, of course, should look at that aspect because they can recover their loss from their agent.
Mr. Hamill, how do we make this distinction between Landry, in which we did not attribute the negligence of the agent, and admittedly that was simply for not doing the title search or for not finding the lien in the title search. And here we have both that as well as not recording. And you're suggesting that we could make a distinction here and saying, well, it's one thing not to find it in the title search, but we won't extend it as far as not filing.
Well, there's nothing unique or professional skill involved with recording a deed of trust.
So the basis of the distinction should be that when you acquire an agent for something that requires some level of expertise, then the negligence is not attributable. But when there is not a level of expertise involved, then it is.
I think that's a reasonable distinction to draw, Justice Martinez, because recording a deed of trust is purely an administrative function. Anybody can record a deed of trust, and I think certainly a sophisticated lender like Ameriquest knows that you record a deed of trust as soon as possible to avoid any intervening liens. And so the fact that this agent sat on his hands for 4 months before recording this deed of trust, and that failure on a part of its agent is the one that caused the problems for Ameriquest in this case, that is definitely attributable to Ameriquest because it was acting through an incompetent agent. And it was not anything that required any kind of special knowledge, such as in Landry, or any special expertise. There is much of the respondent's brief has been dedicated to the idea of unjust enrichment and the equitable lien. I only have a few comments. They seem to think that under the theory of equitable subrogation, one portion of their $550,000 should be in senior position. The remainder should be in a junior position, but should be elevated by the concept of equitable lien. Neither the Court of Appeals nor the trial court made any such distinction. And in fact, if you parse the opinion of the trial court and of the Court of Appeals, they seem to confuse or at least combine the two concepts of equitable subrogation and equitable lien. In any event, there was no unjust enrichment of land title in this case. keep in mind that there was a foreclosure that was already in place. And that was a real estate RE loan, as we refer to it. It was in foreclosure. It was paid off. The redemption took place from funds that were provided by this loan. Land Title, when that foreclosure took place, Land Title was in the position of foreclosing that deed of trust. So its deed of trust was being foreclosed. It was the assignee of that deed of trust. Land Title did not bid the full amount on that loan. That loan or that foreclosure was purchased by Mr. Kovarik, who was totally unrelated to anybody. Mr. Kovarik paid $288,000 for the property in that foreclosure. It was subject to a $70,000 first deed of trust, so somewhere around $300,000, $350,000 was what Mr. Kovarik paid for. Land Title, if it were really intent on stealing this property from AmeriQuest or anyone else, could very easily have redeemed from that foreclosure sale because it held a third deed of trust, the one that ultimately foreclosed in this matter. It did not. The fact that Land Title ultimately bought this property by bidding in the full amount of its loan on the foreclosure sale, then rehabbing it and holding it for 7 months and then selling it, does not indicate any kind of unjust enrichment whatsoever. There was no unjust enrichment at the foreclosure sale. There was no unjust enrichment by someone selling a piece of property that they acquired clean title to in a subsequent transaction. Land Title simply collected the profit, which it ultimately took the risk on when it acquired this piece of property. So the idea that there was some sort of insidious motivation by Land Title to steal this property at a low price simply is not supported by the evidence. And in fact, the only evidence of value of this property is that could be even looked at, it's in the record, is the amount that was paid by Mr. Kovarik. I'd like to turn to the damages issue, which is the third issue that is before the court on certiorari. We have laid out our arguments carefully here, but it's clear that under the concept of equitable subrogation, you only get subrogated to the liens you pay off. There was one lien paid off here. That was the Washington Mutual lien for $72,000, more or less. The other amounts, certainly the amount paid to the Battles in their fraudulent conduct, should not be recovered from us, nor should the amount that is that was the subject to the redemption. There was no lien redemption. There was no lien paid off. Under all of the cases that we've cited, at the very, very most, in this case, the equitable subrogation would apply only to $72,000, not $550,000. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may, Your Honor.
You may.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
Sure.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Fritz Kanak. I am here representing AmeriQuest, the respondents in this matter. I think Justice Bender's question hit it right on the head in terms of the primary consideration of this court, I understand. That has to do with the application of the Mortgage Act to these cases. I mean, clearly, Hicks or Laundry is applicable, at least generally in this instance. And in terms of approaching the Mortgage Act as something of an extension or appendage to that, the issue is exactly that. Before I get there, though, I'd like to raise, with the court's permission, just two real brief points. The first is a comment on the equitable remedy that was fashioned, the remedy itself. And I think if you assume, as I think you need to, and as I think the Court of Appeals expressly did, that one of the underlying policies of the Mortgage Act is to pay off lien holders and to pay off debtors whose debts are secured by the real estate, then the equitable remedy that was fashioned by the trial court below and the Court of Appeals was positively elegant and how it ultimately came up with the result. The purchaser, ultimately, who counsel referred to, and I think was inferring that this was a bona fide purchaser, but in reality it was a lease pendants file. So this was a purchaser with notice of the pendency of the litigation. They got possession of the property. The intervening lien holders were, in fact, all paid, save my client, who was substantially paid under the terms of this equitable decision. But nevertheless, that's substantially paid but not paid in full. Everybody else was put in the proper place that they would have been in under these circumstances. Indeed, the land title claim itself was paid in full, and had my client done what they argued we should have done, which was pay them off during the foreclosure process, they would have been in exactly the same position. The difference here, of course, is that they had reliance costs, which were also paid from the proceeds of this equitable remedy. It was carefully fashioned and wonderfully done. The second thing, and the second point that I want to get to here, is after some decades of being in this profession, I don't often get a chance to say this, but with all due respect, the trial court and the Court of Appeals got it exactly right in this case. Looking at the merits of the case, looking at your own well-enunciated standards in the Hicks case, they saw here an instance where equitable subrogation was, in fact, necessary. Now, making this argument, I'm, of course, casting aside, for the sake of argument right now, the notion that prejudice in this case would be affected to land title by the fact that they were not allowed or would not be allowed under that decision their 400% profit at the expense of the other creditors who were secured on that property. But all that said, I think you'd have to say that this was, in terms of fashioning an equitable remedy, an excellent job of doing exactly what the court needed to do under the facts of this case. And equity is of necessity, as this court has recognized, a factually specific,
Well, that's fine. That's fine. But what about the face of the statute? I mean, the legislature gets an opportunity to secure titles and seems to have been very explicit about the extinguishment of these loans. And if the purchaser wants to fix up property on a rising market and get the benefit of it, what's the problem with that? Why should a court intervene?
Well, I think that this court has, in fact, already intervened in the sense of the Hicks case and Laundry case, where you recognized, as most other courts have, a very narrow exception in equity where unjust enrichment would result as a result of that.
But the unjust enrichment is based upon using your title and then taking the property and fixing it up, right? Is that the unjust enrichment?
Sure. And I think, in fairness, I think the policy here, you know, this is the argument that could have been made on the other side, is that there are competing policies with respect to the Mortgage Act. The primary policy, I would say, and the reason why you have the notification, for example, statutes that are very thorough, notifying all kinds of potential creditors, all those sorts of things, is recognized by this court, is to make sure that the judgment, or that the creditors that whose property interests or whose interests are related to that real estate are paid off. That's fundamental. And if the concern here is making sure, and again, this was reflected in the opinion of the Court of Appeals, citing the Washington case, if the idea here is you want refinancing to occur, if you want property to be in a position where it can be available for sale, if you don't want to have the difficulties that we're seeing in many instances of difficulties relating to financing a property, you have to facilitate, or at least by policy you would want to facilitate, refinancing of property. And you do that by making people who are, as in this case, putting money out with investment expectations and with the belief that they're getting priority, you make sure that they get that priority. You make sure that you allow for that kind of
Well, these are sophisticated commercial operators here, including your client. I mean, yes. I don't see why equity, which might reach in and get protect an unsophisticated consumer, let's say, should be extended to someone like your client.
But indeed, it has been in these kinds of cases. For example,
on the front end, though, but here we're talking about a process that goes all the way through, and you get a certificate, and you get the title, etc.
Well, but you've addressed that again in the standards that were enunciated in Laundry, when you had the five-step process of analysis that you would undertake in this kind of case. And what you said was the most important was the prejudice to the intervening lien holder. And in this particular case, again, it's factually specific in each case, but we're dealing with a very sophisticated member of the industry here on all sides. And in that particular case, what I would argue is, and what you're seeing here is that under the Mortgage Act, for the purposes of refinancing and all that kind of thing, it makes sense to have the person that actually provided the funds to pay off the subsequent lien holders be substituted in their place. And if indeed, here you've got something different. The prejudice that you were talking about in Laundry, I think, had more to do with modifications in the purchase price, extensions in the lien itself. You did indicate the fact that somebody was just simply in the same place was not prejudice. Here, the potential prejudice that would be addressed that's a little bit different is the length of time, the extent of time. I think that if, in fact, for example, we weren't talking about something that was virtually simultaneous, 4 months, but 4 years instead, I think that the argument that's been presented by petitioners would be more compelling on the issue of prejudice. In other words, if you had the landowners in there for 4 years, all this had been forgotten about for 4 years, and then suddenly somebody surfaced, I think the strength of the prejudice argument would go up. Here it does not. And again, it's factually specific based on what happened down below. And prejudice as well in this case would be financial. And in this case, I think it's important to recall that land was put in exactly the same position it would have been in had, in fact, there been a payoff on the foreclosure process. I don't think you do long-term damage, which I believe is this court's concern, real damage to the Mortgage Act, as long as you have the protection that you've already provided for in the Laundry case that deals with the specific issue of prejudice. And again, here the issue of prejudice that wasn't really addressed in Laundry, that I think the Mortgage Act, and especially given the fact that the mortgage foreclosure sale already occurred, here the issue of prejudice would have more to do, I think, with the length of time or the extent of time that was involved. And in this instance, I would argue that simply wasn't the case. There wasn't prejudice here. In fact, they were made completely whole. Now, with respect to the remedies that were provided, I would argue that again, the remedies that were provided here made all the parties whole. Certainly under equitable subrogation, as this court recognized in Hicks, which I keep calling Laundry or Hicks, but I think we're understanding that it's the same case. They are entitled under these facts to place themselves in the position of the prior lien holders. And so much of the discussion that we've been hearing, as I think was pointed out by Justice Coates, the discussion that we were hearing on the other side related to whether or not this was a junior lien or not is irrelevant, at least with respect to the payoff of the prior lien. But a court isn't limited when they're fashioning an equitable remedy to a single remedy. Obviously, in this particular instance, the courts found the need to have or review additional remedies, including the issue of an equitable lien in this case. And that gets directly to the issue of whether or not there was unjust enrichment and whether or not, under the law of this state, it would have been inappropriate to find unjust enrichment in this case. I think the facts here clearly show that unjust enrichment did occur. You have, as was indicated, and again, I'm aware of the fact that here, on the other side, they're alleging that there has to be some kind of wrongdoing. Things could be inferred from the facts in this case, but we're not saying that it's even necessary to have a wrongdoing here. Because as we read DCB Construction, and as cited in the Layden case, the elements of unjust enrichment are simply that something has to be at the plaintiff's expense, in this case AmeriQuest, defendant, in this case petitioner, received a benefit under circumstances making it unjust to retain it without paying for it. In this particular case, clearly what happened is that there was a windfall, a significant windfall at the expense of the other creditors in this case. And we would argue that under those circumstances, equity would require that something be paid for the benefit that was received. That
what,
did not.
What do you do with the fact that your agent did not file or record this lien?
Well, again, I think as this court recognized in the Hicks case, sophisticated title insurance companies, or in this case, sophisticated lenders, rely on, and this is true in the industry throughout the country, they rely on the actions of their title insurance providers to provide these things. And as this court recognized, the negligence of that agent is not something that is going to be necessarily imputed on AmeriQuest in this case.
Why not? I don't understand that. Because here it seems that was your agent, who apparently did nothing to file this with, for 4 months. And wouldn't AmeriQuest have a remedy against the title company?
Well, in this particular case, though, and I think that this was in the stipulated, in the stipulation, the title company actually did do a certain amount of due diligence, not the least of which was to request an LOI, which would have been a standard in the industry, and did do something to get some understanding and determination as to whether or not, or the position that Land Title would take, and relied on that. Now, in retrospect, I'm sure that they wish they hadn't done it that way, but nevertheless, there was some action. It wasn't just simply nonfeasance on their part. There were some affirmative steps that were taken. And yes, I mean, in theory, it's possible that if, in fact, there's actionable negligence, that they could subsequently recover that against the agent. But it appears to me, as I read Colorado law, however, that that would not necessarily be imputed in this particular case to AmeriQuest, the action of the agent in this event. At least for purposes of the analysis of whether an equitable remedy ought to be available to AmeriQuest in this context.
Well, so am I right that what you're telling me now is that that doesn't mean AmeriQuest had dirty hands just because its agent did not record the lien?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
I'm unsatisfied with the answer. Why didn't you simultaneously file against the agent for negligence, for failure to record? I mean, or did you?
To my knowledge, that was not done, Your Honor. I was not representing my client at that point.
Well, you know, it's the Hicks case it has very limiting language upon the application of this equitable remedy.
Right.
And it goes to the facts of the case and so on. And I'm concerned that this is in the face of a statute that at some point clears off the lien so that business and the market may go on. And so I don't know why we should be protecting the agent that you ought to be suing, perhaps, between sophisticated dealers in this very industry.
Well, that gets back to the point.
And it seems to me that's the net effect of.
Sure. And I don't think I was clear in my earlier answer to your question about the policies that underline the act. To be sure, I mean, it's the same thing could be said of the Recording Act. It has to do with the reason why you don't want to have exceptions to the Recording Act generally is because you want title to be freely marketable, and the way you make it freely marketable is you make sure that these kinds of hidden liens, quote unquote, aren't out there, can't impede property. Mm-hmm. Same argument's the case here. But you have two parallel policies that are at play here. One, to be sure, is that once the foreclosure has occurred, it's marketable, you'll get people to go out, you'll get people to invest, you'll get people to sell. But the other part of it, which is more fundamental, and is the way that it's been set up, is to make sure before all that happens that the lien holders, that the people that put the money into the property are paid off with whatever proceeds are there. Those march hand in hand, but it's one doesn't go without the other. And the policy part of the argument that I'm making here is that the part that requires, that, or at least has as a policy, that the lien holders be paid was in fact part of the statute, the policy, that the equitable remedy in fact did cure in this case. Now, in the end, the result's the same. You have another owner who's in there who paid valuable consideration for the property, and with this remedy in place, they have a wonderful home. It was accomplished in this particular case. I understand that what the argument you're making has to do with making land freely available. That's every bit as true under the Recording Act, and was an issue that was very true at the time of the Hicks case as well. That applies. But here, there's an additional factor, and I want to emphasize that, is the fact that the Mortgage Act itself is designed to pay off the creditors, and the creditors were paid off here and would not have been.
Mr. Knack, what did AmeriQuest do? I think they learned about the sale to Petersons in March of 2004. What did they do to protect their interests, and when did they do it?
Well, they filed a lease pendants.
And when was that? I think Mr. Hamill in his brief says that you filed it in September.
And I would have to refer, I apologize, to the stipulation. I don't know the answer, but it is the stipulated facts.
Isn't that sort of not necessarily dirty hands, but more lack of attention to the problem?
Well, the issue isn't one in equity, the arcane world of equity. It isn't really one of dirty hands. I think that here, AmeriQuest marched forward with clean hands. The argument that comes up here, and that's really the prejudice argument again, is latches in the context of equity. Whether or not too much time expired to make it fair. And that's really, when you get to the crux of it, what the prejudice standard is that was enunciated in Dix. And I would say that the answer to that question is no. It is not unclean hands on their part. They acted as soon as they knew there was a problem. And to be sure, if they had it to do all over again, I'm sure there's all kinds of things they would have done. But they acted in their interests to protect themselves as soon as they thought there was a problem. Again, I would just emphasize, and one key point, and then I'm going to sit down. If there are any other questions. We're used to much, much shorter appellate arguments. And that is, no real prejudice occurs here in the upholding of the decision of the Court of Appeals. All of the parties save my client have been made whole. There is no harm to anyone upholding the decision of the Court of Appeals here in Ecuador. That is, in effect,
the one possible harm would be that their entrepreneurial effort in fixing up the property is, and the reward for that is divested, right? I mean, isn't there some harm to their position and reliance on the title?
Well, I think for purposes of expectations involved in real estate transactions ordinarily, in terms of what they had originally invested in terms of what the other people had invested in.
Yeah, but there's a change of circumstances. That is, they take the title and they act on it to improve the property.
Well, but that's, if in fact they were a bona fide purchaser, I think that the argument would be stronger than it is.
Okay.
In this particular instance, I think what you're dealing with is someone who had actual knowledge, or at least it could be imputed.
So they shouldn't have made the investment to improve the property.
Well, that was certainly an additional risk factor, because what they did is they did with the understanding, or they should have known, that in fact that was the case. Somebody obviously had come in and paid off the prior liens. They're sophisticated investors. They're sophisticated in members of this industry. And they get it. They knew that somebody had paid off those prior liens. And they were taking advantage of the situation, undoubtedly, in the hope that, and that's the risk they took, in the hope that whoever that was didn't assert their valid position, equitable or otherwise. That was the risk they took. So yes, I mean, I understand the general policy argument about the need for investment and the need for people to buy these kinds of properties and take care of it. But bottom line here is, part of the risk they took
So another lender, by not protecting themselves, can depress the market for improving property. That's not a public policy problem in your
Well, the countervailing policy, as I see that, because as I said, there's a policy that marches hand in hand with that, is that you don't even get to that point if you don't pay off the prior lien holders. And if in fact, you know, as in this case, you develop a remedy that pays off the prior lien holders, then you get to the point where somebody can come in and invest and market the property.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Council states that the policy of the Colorado statutes, the foreclosure statutes and so forth, is fundamentally to pay off all of the lien holders. There's no citation of authority to support that position in their briefs or otherwise. However, I think I could concede that that should be a general public policy. You have secured lenders who have perfected their interests and who are protected by the recording statute should have the opportunity to redeem, which AmeriQuest would have had in this circumstance had it recorded its deed of trust. to say that it was not negligent on their part to perform this simple administrative task through a title company is a nonsensical approach, in my view. Let's assume that they'd given it to a secretary and said, here, please record this deed of trust, and she didn't record it for 4 months. Her function was the same as the title company. There's no special responsibility, no special sophistication or knowledge that's required to record a deed of trust. It certainly wouldn't be here arguing that their failure, their secretary to record for 4 months should not be attributed to them. Same argument should be made here. So long as the title company is doing nothing more than administrative function, that negligence should be attributed to them. So if they had done simply what they were entitled to do and should have done, they would have been protected. The policy of paying off all of the lien holders is no greater policy than the policy that's expressly set forth in the recording title statute, recording in the foreclosure title statute.
Mr. Hamill, can you respond to the argument made right at the end that that your client was in some sort of inquiry notice position, that is, had reason to believe that there was a lien out there which was unrecorded?
Their argument is that somehow or another we knew that the redemption had occurred and that the Washington Mutual loan had been paid off, and therefore we should know that there was a lien out there. Those funds could have come from anywhere. It could have been an inheritance to the Bettles. It could have been money coming from the TARP fund. It could have been anywhere. There is no duty of inquiry. But the duty of inquiry should be on them. They, in fact, have constructive notice by our recording of a demand of foreclosure that a foreclosure is proceeding. So if anybody was on a duty of inquiry, it was Ameriquest, not only because of that fact, but also because of the four-month delay. One other thing that I don't want to get lost in this shuffle. We talk about the liability of the title company for its negligence. How about the liability of the Battles? Why are we being called upon to pay off what amounts to most of a $700,000 judgment against the Battles, which has been entered in this case on behalf of Ameriquest? I have no knowledge, none in the record, sir.
Just remind me, what did they do? What's their...
Fraud, Your Honor. Negligent misrepresentation, fraudulent withholding, you know, a whole panoply of misconduct on their part. They did not defend this lawsuit after their counsel withdrew about halfway through. Judgments were entered in against them. Let Ameriquest go collect from them. They're the wrongdoers in this case, not land title and not title acquisitions. Let Ameriquest go collect from its agent, who has clearly breached his duty to act without negligence. The basic policy, when we talk about the policy of making sure that everybody gets paid off, the basic policy of the recording statute and the foreclosure statute is to make sure that title is clean. If we do not allow title to be cleaned up by the foreclosure statute and wipe out liens such as the one that are being asserted here, when a person bids at the foreclosure sale, she's going to have to take that into consideration. The real policy is to make the title sure so that people who are bidding know they're not going to have this kind of a fight.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments, and we will go.